Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give, and there is no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off, and every now and then, or once every time you listen, it's really up to you. Click on the supporter link in the episode description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your contribution.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Chris Lake, and you're now listening to the House Culture Podcast.
House Culture.
Hi there, everybody. I'm pleased to welcome you to another episode of the House Culture Podcast with me, your host, the managing editor at House Culture, Matt Rouse. Thank you for taking the time to seek us out and press play today. It's a pleasure to be talking to you. And if you're a fan, please remember to do all that good stuff for us by loving, liking and shouting from the rooftops about this show. We couldn't do this podcast without your support, so please keep spreading the word. But if you're new here, thanks for joining us. We are House Culture, a collective of house music fans who have come together through their mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. The main event is over on Instagram at HouseCultureNet, so make sure you follow that as well so that you can rub shoulders with over 165,000 other party people from the world over. This season of episodes has been our biggest ever, so if you haven't already, please flick through our incredible back catalogue of episodes featuring club culture conversations with legends such as Todd Terry, Roger Sanchez, Judge Jules and Paul Oakenfold. Even further back, you can tune into the musings of new school innovators like Josh Butler, Amsterdam-based artist Luke Van Dyke, or dons of progressive house like Dave Seaman, Danny Tenaglia and Nick Muir. There really is something to suit all tastes, and even if you don't recognise that name, you should dive in to hear what is always a fascinating story. Speaking of which, let's hear from this month's guest, who is none other than DJ, Grammy-nominated producer and Black Book label owner, Chris Lake. In our chat, Chris tells us how he first discovered the dance music that he loves.
I went to the bar that night, and then there was a private party next door in the club. The DJ that was playing progressive house. And I was like, what the fuck is this? This is amazing.
How he operates when creating in the studio.
I tweak things to death. I listen to sections of songs and just really try to make sure that transitions and sections move between one another and just invoke the feeling that I intend. I know how I want things to feel, and I'm relentless. I'm absolutely relentless in not stopping until I achieve that.
And what prompted him to make the move out to the US?
I was getting a lot of work out in America. There was traction happening with my records, and I really enjoyed the attitude out here. Just felt like you could do whatever you wanted. It was kind of accepted. I enjoyed that. I'm honestly doing shows right now I never, ever thought I'd be doing, and having influence in a way even that I never thought I'd ever have. It's unbelievable. It's mind-boggling. It's great fun.
So, I hope you enjoy this one. This is Chris Lake.
House Culture.
Hi Chris, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the House Culture podcast today. You're from the UK and now reside in the US. You've played all over the world, headlined festivals and released many anthems. However, we always like to roll it back to the beginning and ask, where did you grow up and how did you first discover music that you loved?
Well, thanks for having me. All right, well, this is all the easy stuff. So, I'm English. I born in Norwich, Norfolk. Mm-hmm. Lived there. I'm always a bit vague on the years. I think I lived there till I was about 13. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I remember I just started becoming a rebellious little shit of a teen, and then I left, and then I kind of like became a bit better behaved. Then moved to Northern Ireland. Uh-huh. And right before I moved to Northern Ireland, I just started taking keyboard lessons, like the organ kind of lessons. So the two-tiered keyboard with the foot pedals,
yeah,
with the bass pedals. And so I went to the Technic School of School of Music and learned some. So that was my first introduction to music there. Then and then moved to Northern Ireland, stopped doing music. I was there for a year and then moved to Scotland, mm-hmm. when I was 14 or 15. And lived there for 10, 11 years, something like that. Then moved to London,
yeah,
now to LA.
Yeah.
And here we are.
No way. See, I mean, a tour of the British Isles to begin with.
Yeah. I've been about, the only one I haven't been to is Wales. because of the point in my life when I moved,
yeah,
it's absolutely destroyed my accent. I sound like a complete mongrel. in accent terms, it's like, I think about it with dogs, it's like when a Labrador breeds with a poodle.
Yeah.
I've got a bit of a Labradoodle accent.
Yeah,
English people know there's something up. Scottish people think I'm English.
Yeah.
Americans think I'm Australian.
Of course.
I just know that I sound completely fucked up. So let's call it international.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you do listen back, don't be afraid of hearing your own voice. It's
I'm used to it now. I've heard it so much, and I'm like, oh god, I'm just used to being a mongrel.
Cool. I mean, and so when you were traveling around, you said you learned the organ, and what was that influence then? Was it did you have musical parents and music was always on in the house? What, how did that come?
I didn't have musical parents, but I had musical grandparents. So my grandfather on my father's side, he played the organ in the church, actually. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like his hobby. He was very good at it. He was very talented at that. And I remember going up, I used to, when I'd go over to my grandparents' houses, they both had essentially like the modern versions of the church organs.
Yeah.
I don't even know what they're called. But anyway, I used to go over there and I'd always mess around and learn how to play. And so my grandfather on my mother's side, he had a slightly more interesting story. He was a saxophonist in the 50s and 60s with in this quite prominent band in Birmingham. I can't remember the name of it. It'll come to me. There was this band that he was in, and they had records on vinyl and stuff like that. He was the saxophonist in the band, and at one point they were out in Hamburg, mm-hmm. in Germany, performing on the same night as the Beatles. When the Beatles were over in Germany performing, this is when with the original members, before they had the change of I can't remember the names of everyone who changed, but anyway, it was a nice little claim to fame. But after that, he kind of the saxophone playing became just a hobby, and he got on with the rest of his life. But anyway, there was this musical influence. I used to go over to my grandparents' houses and play around with the keyboard. But it was my grandfather, the one that played the saxophone. He was like, I think you've got some talent, and he encouraged my mother to get me to go and do those lessons.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's when things really started to kickstart. They began, and I. Essentially, when I was doing those lessons, I ended up doing live performances and stuff, and I was much better at the performing than I was at any of the practical stuff. I was a bit unconventional with pretty much everything I did. Didn't follow all of the rules of what they were teaching me, but I guess I had my own flair. Anyway, when I moved, I stopped doing that. And then when I got to Scotland, I took music up as one of my options for the
GCSEs.
GCSEs, yeah. And there I met a friend who was making music on keyboards and synthesizers. And I just thought it was the best thing ever. Mm-hmm. I realized that you can actually make your own stuff, make your own sounds. And and that's when I started trying to learn about music and try to understand this whole world. So this would have been in the 90, mm-hmm. I guess, 97, 98. I picked up future music and computer music. That was my whole thing. And dove in head first to music production, realized, yeah, okay, I need money to buy equipment, mm-hmm, started getting jobs as a teenager during all my school holidays and weekends and that to start making money to buy synthesizers, buy mixers and things like that, because it wasn't like buying a computer and then just putting a bit of crack software on your computer and getting going. It wasn't quite that time. Mm. So I've invested into making music and, you know, just got going. Yeah. You know, just essentially invested in this little hobby that then started building some momentum. Yeah. And here I am.
And here you are.
Many, many years later. So.
Yeah, well, it all paid off in the end. I mean, so, you know, you're in Scotland and you're like 14 or whatever you said. You're getting all this equipment, mm-hmm, you're getting all this stuff together. So it's very much like you were well into that kind of production bent before you had like a clubbing life. I mean, where did the two kind of collide? And did you, when you first went out kind of clubbing and having that experience with electronic music, did you get inspired?
I'm trying to think how I could explain how best to explain it, but I didn't have that kind of like that necessarily stereotypical clubbing experience like a lot of people did. Mm. I lived in a really, really rural part of the country. For me to go to events was a lot of effort, a lot of travel, a lot of rallying of the troops. not particularly that hard when you're young, but you know, for if I really wanted to go to really good club nights and that, I drove down to Glasgow or Edinburgh. That was a 3-hour drive.
Wow.
No one enjoys that kind of travel, you know, like at any point. And that was, you know, but that wasn't until I was really 18 and I'd drive down to Colours and the Arches and stuff like that. And mm-hmm, that was like they were some of my really good experiences. But like, I essentially learned about dance music in like this sort of almost this voyeuristic kind of way. I was on message boards and I would just try, mm-hmm, to learn and understand what was going on in the scene in other places. I just tried to like read about it and visualize what it was about and try, yeah, to understand it. And that was really that was how I started. So I started on, there was two particular message boards that I was on all the time. Mm-hmm. Huge Tunes message board. Mm-hmm. A classic kind of this trance record label, yep, if you know looking back on it, and the Global Underground,
of course, board. Yeah,
Global Underground was huge.
Yeah, so. I think we're a similar age, so yeah.
yeah, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. So I was an opinionated fuckwit that just thought, you know kind of like developed that sort of highbrow, most things are shit unless Sasha and Digweed have done it, you know kind of thing.
I think that was just the GU board all over, really, wasn't it?
That was the GU board all over, yeah. And that kind of defined everything that I loved and wanted to do when I was like in the early 2000s. I just wanted to. I thought the coolest thing to do was to try and make records that Sasha and Digweed would play. That's what I did.
Well, indeed, yeah. I mean, you know, so you said you had that kind of voyeuristic view. I mean, we've spoken to loads of DJs and producers on the podcast and they have this kind of through line of, you know, going to a club, having that experience, getting some decks, getting some momentum behind their career and then going out and getting gigs and things like that. But this was, I take it, you were maybe producing more and trying to get your tracks into the hands of these people you admired.
Okay, so this is the one thing that I didn't mention was that soon after that, I started DJing. I did start DJing. I started doing like underage events in my local area, and I'd play, you know, pop music and stuff like that, and try and feed in like the dance music that I was listening to at the time that wasn't particularly, you know, it was like the dance music for the commoner at the time, like for the common ear, like not the commoner, the, think of it like Ministry of Sound kind of dance music, like ATB,
yeah,
9 a.m. till I come,
Dario G, that kind of like
all of that sort of stuff. That was like, so when I was at the time, what I was doing was I was essentially, I didn't really know how to write original music. I didn't so I was kind of trying to recreate all of these like dance tracks. That was all I did. I just tried to recreate sounds and try to recreate the feel. Mm-hmm. That's how I got started in music. That's what I was doing early on.
Yeah.
But I was DJing, and then I remember I was a DJ at this local club. The club was connected to a bar, and I on this one night there was a private party. So I went to the bar that night, and then there was a private party next door in the club. Mm-hmm. And I peeked in, and like the DJ that was playing was playing Progressive House, and that was the, and I was like, what the fuck is this? This is amazing. Just like, and when I say Progressive House, like for anyone listening now, I'm talking like prog, as in the GU kind of like the GU board kind of prog. It's like, it's not, I think when people say Progressive House now, they think of like Hardwell and like the kind of like the EDM-y sort of like progressive. It wasn't that. Anyway, so I thought this is unbelievable. And I remember going up to the guy that was playing, who's now one of my lifelong friends. Mm-hmm. It's like, hi, I'm Chris. I'm a music producer, you know, and I'd love to send you a demo. And it turned out he was a head butcher at the local Safeway, you know, and he was just DJing on the side. And I remember taking a demo tape to him in the Safeway. I haven't thought about it. Years. It's really funny talking about this, and dropping off a demo to him at Safeway, and then him contacting me a little bit later. We became friends, and then he kind of like, you know, he sort of like showed me the way and like introduced me to a load of like this music that I'd never really heard, and that's how I got into the whole. I want to know more about this. So the way that I learned about that was I went onto the internet, mm-hmm. on my dial-up internet, and went onto the message boards and tried to learn about this music. So that's how I got into it.
Yeah. I mean, and this was an era, obviously, before like social media, before like you had to really dig for this stuff and to find those communities online to be able to, you know, these people are listening to what I like, and, you know, to go in there and learn about this. And, you know, then you have to have that persona as well. You know, you have to shout very loud on those boards to get noticed and to have an opinion. And
yeah. Well, that's actually how I first got noticed. Mm. There was a guy that was working with Huge Tunes at the time, Bobby M. Bobby, I don't actually remember exactly what he was doing, but he approached me about, I posted some of my demos on the Huge Tunes message board, and he responded and says, I really like these. I'd like to, would you be interested in being managed? I'm like, done. Let's go. Let's crack on. This is amazing. I've made it. You know, couldn't believe that people were like paying any attention to what I was doing. And off the back of that, I ended up getting the one of the demos that I'd done was called Santiago de Cuba. Mm-hmm. And that was played to Red Jerry, who was the A&R, the head together, the owner of Huge Tunes, and the A&R. And they said they wanted to sign it and put it out on Lost Language. Mm-hmm. And then I realized I'd lost the project for the song.
Oh, shit.
And I had this render. I spent months trying to recreate it. And I was like, oh, fuck it. I had this 192K MP3.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to convert it to a WAV and then just submit it. And that's that's what's released.
Oh, my God. No way.
That's what's released. That was my first. I was like, I'm not missing this opportunity. Mm. I'm not missing this opportunity, so I took my opportunity. I just submitted the 192K MP3, and that got me started. So that was my first original song. I remember making that with my MC505 and Roland MC505 and my all these other synthesizers. But that was mostly made on that.
Yeah,
actually, I was starting to use computers to record by that point.
Mm.
And that was half the problem. I wasn't very good at using all that software. And I just like, I was backing things up and it all went to shit. But anyway, yeah, that was the first song.
Oh, man. So
ask me another question. Give me more direction.
Yeah, yeah. So in terms of like having that released on Lost Language, obviously Lost Language was like the subsidiary of Huge, wasn't it? It was like a bit more, I suppose, a bit more progressive. What was that moment like when maybe you went somewhere and saw someone playing it, or someone told you that someone had played it or anything like that? Was there any...
Yeah, which is nice. I think that was, you know, that's really at the core of everything that I've ever loved in the scene. I just like making music that gets reactions from people. I've always loved it. It's nice. Like, I still connect to that feeling, that feeling exactly today, you know, to music I made yesterday. It's exactly the same thing that I'm looking for. It's sort of like at the core of my my drive and my values. It's just fun. It's really fun.
Yeah, you know, it's an unquenchable fire. It's, you know, it's that's what always should burn. Like that creativity is something it should always stoke.
But at the root of it, it's kind of, you know, it is, it's quite selfish. A lot of it's for me. I like it. It fuels me. But I also like the beautiful side effect of it is it comes from making people happy.
Yeah.
Great. I think so. I hope it makes more people happy than it makes people go, you know, but anyway, I'll never know. I'll focus on the happiness side of it.
Indeed. And so, I mean, for me, like, you know, we've talked about like the GU board and things like that. And, you know, you certainly came to my attention like back in, it was about, I think it was like 2002, and you did like the re-edit of the Prodigy's Climatize. You know, and that was before things like SoundCloud existed and stuff like that. And I always loved that tune on Fat of the Land, that album. And I always thought there should have been like a dancier version of it.
All right. So I'll tell you the story about that one. I don't remember all of the details, but I remember what it resulted in. I kind of had a bit of a hooky distribution thing going on with, for some of my bootlegs I was making. I was making quite a few of them at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember that record must have got some radio play. And I remember I know that I'd seeded a copy of it to Sasha Digweed. I'd seeded it to some of the main DJs that were playing, and it was it got absolutely rinsed by all of the main headliners at what was the big festival at the time? It wasn't
Homelands, yeah.
Homelands and like Creamfields and there was only a few festivals at the time around about that time, but it was like the main festivals that were playing, that song got rinsed. And anyway, I contacted that distribution, and I paid to get a load of copies of that record made, and I got them shipped to my house up in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And I remember we ordered 3,000 copies.
Yeah.
I don't know if this rings any bells if you had a copy, because we said on the copy on the record,
does it say 1,000? One of 500.
One of 500.
I've still got my copy downstairs somewhere. I'll have to dig it out.
This is the thing. That copy was so we got them all shipped to the house, and we didn't pay for the labels. I remember to save money, because my father at the factory that he works at, he had a label maker. So to save money, we got them all shipped to the house, and then we made the labels at my father's factory, and we all sat there, met my family, and we all labeled up the records ourselves, and then and sold them directly to 10 record stores. And we sold all, I mean, I remember like Hard to Find, mm-hmm. I swear Hard to Find Records, they bought 2,000 of them just alone.
Yeah,
which is a lot. That was a lot of records. If you were selling over 1,000 records, it was pretty unbelievable at that time, because no one was buying music. Nobody. Mm-hmm. It was all like it was really, really hard. That was one of the most unfortunate things of like the era that I came up. I missed all of the financial ability to sustain yourself through only making music.
Yeah,
it all went to shit, and it's kind of like it's fucked. Well, I was really happy that I could make anything. I sold all 3,000 copies, and it was really, really popular, and it was really fun. But it's one of my fondest memories of being sat there in the living room with my whole family labeling up the records and then shipping them out to the record stores. But I remember calling up all the record stores and trying to and making the orders for the, like, how many do you want to buy?
Amazing. It's just hilarious that there is, I should have bought it in the room here and shown it to you. That would have been a weird serendipitous moment that it's all gone full circle. So after that, like, that was 2002, obviously it had blown up, it had been absolutely rinsed. Like, what was the next step for you? You know, obviously in 2006, when like Changes came out, that was like, felt like the big moment, like your arrival. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that was the moment where everything started becoming legitimate. Before that, I was fucking around, to be honest with you. But in that period between Climatize and that point, I got a little bit lost. Mm-hmm. The original guy that I told you about, Bobby, he passed away many years ago. He stopped working with him, and I wasn't being managed, and because I wasn't really working very efficiently or anything, and I got to this pivotal point where I'm like, I need to get my shit together. I gave about a year before that Changes record came out, I gave myself a year. I'm like, I said to my friends and family, I'm like, if I don't make something significant happen with my career here, within a year, I'll pivot and I'll pursue education and a career, you know, build something more tangible. And so I started working really hard. And at the time I was working at, I was a postman, the post office. I did that for 3 years. I was doing that for 32 hours a week. And so in all the off time, I was just working really hard, just trying to make music. And that's where I made, there was a brace of records that really got my attention. There was Changes, Release, One Too Many, and Fantasy, I think. And that was where I started. There were tunes where I started Rising Music to release my own music. I signed Changes to Alternative Route, Desi Masiello's label, because he wanted to put that on his compilation. And then I got a manager. I started working with Dean Wilson, who's now at 720 Management, founded 360 Management, and was with the company that was responsible for myself, Deadmau5, and Calvin Harris. So started working with him, and things, you know, things really just like spiraled off the back of that. That's where I started becoming professional. But still, I mean, like, I look back at it and I didn't, you know, I was just still that kid that was like still trying to like look at things from a distance and trying to understand what the fuck I was and what I was doing. Visually, I didn't have a clue what I was doing. I didn't know what I was presenting to the world. But the one thing that I felt I was always pretty good at was just making the music. How I was presenting it to the world was pretty fucked. I'm definitely a lot better at doing that now. But but things, you know, that's where I really started internationally touring, and I haven't stopped since.
Yeah. So, you know, to go from that kind of, like you say, like being a postman, bit of a wide-eyed kid still, and then, you know, huge, you're traveling the world and playing gigs and whatever, you know, was there ever a moment where, what, thinking back, like, what was a real kind of holy shit moment for you?
I mean, there's been loads of them.
Specifically around that kind of era where it's kind of, it really started to take
off. I think getting a record in the top 40 and was great. I mean, looking back on it, look, there's been moments where I've allowed external influence to kind of to guide me to do things that I probably just naturally wouldn't want to do. For example, like getting the vocal on Changes was absolutely not my idea. I definitely did not want to do it, and I didn't feel comfortable with it. I never loved the idea of putting a vocal on there. I completely think that vocal works, but it doesn't. It doesn't give the same feeling that the original did in its instrumental form. That was how I intended it to feel. But anyway, you know, that happened. And then, you know, over time I learned how to do those records myself and write those vocals myself. You know, but that's just evolution. So, but that was a really great moment, like getting, you know, doing my first major record deal and, or signing, you know, signing a single to someone. And so I did that to Apollo, which was Universal, I think, and you know, getting my first big advance was huge for me. You know,
what did you buy with it?
Well, I got 25 grand for it. I got 25 grand for the single, which is really annoying because there was another offer on the table from Ministry that was far, far bigger. But there was the label manager for Alternative Route had a really good relationship with Apollo, and she really wanted to go that route. So I went along with it, and so anyway, I paid off my student loan. I cleared the debt on my car, and I put a down payment on the house.
Very sensible. Yeah.
I lived off the back of it. Honestly, I've been pretty sensible with this stuff. So I think.
Cool. And I mean, you know, obviously we're talking about that Changes of like 2006, you know, it's 2023 now. So, you know, how has your production process changed over that time? You know, is it inconceivably different from like where it was back then to now, or do you still hold some things dear in terms of, I love this bit of equipment, I'm always going to use that?
Mentally I'm the same, but I mean, when I didn't use Ableton when I was, you know, when I first started, I just rinse Ableton now. I'm very, very quick. I used to only work in a studio. Now I kind of, it's funny. I was talking about this last night with my friend downstairs. I worked yesterday and I must have worked on 10 projects. I'm not kidding. I was just like hot swapping between like different things that I'm working on, making little adjustments. And I did everything in my echoey kitchen on the laptop speakers.
No way.
And I made final mix adjustments and rendered out the track and submitted it to a label. Wow. I didn't even check it on speakers. Like, it's just weird. That's different. That's kind of how I work like that now. And I kind of I trust my ears. I trust my, you know, trust my environments. And,
yeah, and yeah, all, yeah. And like having just, that trust in
I know what I'm doing. There was a lot more guesswork before. I was kind of like, you know, I hadn't done my 10,000 hours I feel like it's ironic. I feel like I really hit the point where I felt like I knew what I was doing about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I remember when I hit 30 and I was like, okay, something's changed here. Like, this is starting to click.
Yeah.
It really started to feel like, you know, like I'd moved into a different phase.
Well, you're talking about listening to new material there that you're making and trusting your own ears and having that, you know, that trust in yourself and that confidence. You know, how are you when you're dealing with that new material? Do you like to road test it and tweak things after the fact, or do you just finalize it and like, bang, it's done, it's out?
No. I tweak things to death.
Yeah.
I really do. And it's a strange, uncomfortable process. I find it quite emotional, actually. Like, not in like a, like, I'm going to break down and sob kind of thing, but I really like, I listen to sections of songs and just really try to make sure that transitions and sections move between one another and just invoke the feeling that I intend. And that's one thing I've got, you know, I can recognize in my older music that I was kind of like starting to become in tune with. And now I've just got, like, now through the better understanding of technology and how to use it. And, I've learned how to accentuate those moments and things that are the feelings that I want to portray in my music and execute them. But essentially I know how I want things to feel, and I'm relentless. I'm absolutely relentless in not stopping until I achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a miserable process. It's a fucking miserable process. It really is. I get really pissed off in this room sometimes trying to pursue it. Mm-hmm. However, I do think that I do think it separates me from quite a lot of people, where, in my opinion, maybe it's just because that's what I focus on, but it's sort of like detail that I think is absent in a lot of people's work that would be in a similar space to mine. Not everyone's, but like a lot of people's. So, it's just something I put a lot of focus into. So it's especially when I have a lot of faith in the idea, mm-hmm. I put a lot of effort into trying to execute it exactly the way that I want to do it.
Like you say, if it's a miserable experience if you're hot swapping between loads of different projects as well, and like continually tweaking and tweaking across multiple different things.
I mean, that's not necessarily so typical. It was just how it ended up yesterday. I was absolutely on one. I was like, the other thing is I've got quite important shows coming up. I have a reason to try and get things finished. So it's given me a bit of urgency to try and make things happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Yeah. So when you're working as well, you've obviously done some collaborations over the years and worked with people like Armin van Helden and like all sorts of different artists and singers and creatives and whatever. Like, how do you like collaboration? Do you like an element of control? How, what's your flow in the studio when you're collaborating?
No, I love it. It's an opportunity to experience a different energy from people, a different vantage point, new ideas, new sounds. But just sometimes, you know, it's just about, look, I've worked with lots of people, and I always emphasize this, and I wish that more people would do this. I arrange to get in a room with people, and we talk about working or whatever, or talk about meeting up, and I have no intention on the end product. It's not like that's not my focus. I'm far more focused immediately on making a connection with the person, and the vibes feeling good. I don't want to work with people that I don't get on with. I don't want to work with people where for the goal of trying to become more popular, or you know, trying to tap into someone's market and reach. Yeah. I've got no interest in that. I want to work with people that I genuinely want to work with. And I really, really enjoy it. And, you know, so really it's just about kind of like inviting people over and having fun and, you know, just trying to fuel the soul. I have a great time here. I love working with people.
Yeah, well, it's a good creed to have, you know, to stick by that and just feel, yeah, like you say, no end product, no foresight in terms of what you're going to be putting out. It's just about, yeah, just getting on with someone and seeing how you bounce ideas off each other.
Well, I will say this as well. It's like, I mean, I understand like the perception that people have of like different artists and, you know, maybe what people, the perception that people might have of me. And I've always found it's quite a nice tool as well to expand the possibility of who I can actually get in the room with and who I can work with, where I go. I've said it to many people. I'm just like, look, you know, if you're down, let's hang, see if we, you know, maybe play some stuff in the studio to each other, and if there's a vibe, see what happens.
Yeah.
And you know, and that's happened on several occasions and brought about some great results, you know, working with people that maybe people wouldn't expect me to to work with.
Yeah,
like Green Velvet or or Grimes, for example. Grimes is a great example.
Yeah,
we had a great time in the studio. We had a great time. Had a great laugh.
Yeah, that's great. You know, and in terms of having that open mind, you know, you obviously work with new talent. You run Black Book Records. You know, that started in 2017. You know, and that was also before that you did Rising Records as well. You know, what was your ideas around starting a label? Why did you want to do that?
Initially, it was just to release my own music. And then, I mean, soon after, I definitely started realizing, you know, there was an ability to kind of help and be involved in other people's careers. You know, like there was the early involvement with seeing the potential in Deadmau5 was quite influential on me when I ended up getting sent a vinyl of his side project, BSOD. BSOD was his collaboration. That was Joel and Steve Duda. Steve Duda is the creator of the synthesizer, the VST Serum, which everyone uses.
Mm-hmm.
So that, yeah. So Steve and Joel had made this track called BSOD, a bit sketchy. It was sent to me on vinyl, and I contacted the distributor, and I was like, what the fuck is this? I've not heard anything like this before. It stood out a country mile. The production was ridiculous. It was like, it was just different. And I remember finding out who it was, reaching out to Joel, starting to speak to him online, sending music, realizing, oh my God, there's something really good here.
Mm.
Ended up going out and working with him for 2 weeks and realizing this whole situation and what the potential was with him. And I remember calling my manager at the time, and Dean, and saying, you've got to sign this kid. You have to sign this kid. And I remember the quote as clear as day. And I said to him, you get it right with him, he'll make you millions. And it was, I told Joel, you know, there's an option here. Mm-hmm. And they ended up working together. They're still together. Amazing. They made each other millions. So that was influential on me. Yeah. That was influential on me because I'm able to tell those stories. Mm-hmm. But I also had no financial involvement in that. An astute version of me probably could have had an involvement in that, but I didn't. I never had any financial involvement at all. So, but it was influential. It was nice to feel like I could be part of helping people. It made me feel good.
Yeah.
Same thing as like making me feel good about like getting feedback on my own music. I like that feeling. I like the feeling of helping people. Mm-hmm. And when they have talent. And he's a difficult human, but he's a bloody talented musician, and he made a huge mark on the scene, and I'm very proud of that. Leading on to that, it was quite funny, you know, I was talking about this with him the other day, but I was with Skrillex. Mm-hmm. And Skrillex really got his big break on Deadmau5's label, so it's like full circle. Mm-hmm. It's like I feel like I said this to Sonny, I'm like, you know, you've got to ask yourself a question, like would it all have worked the same way if Mouse hadn't had that start and like, you know, linked up with Dean and kind of like had the trajectory that he had. And so I was like, so yeah, basically I created Skrillex. But we, you know, we hang out now. He's like, he's one of my closest friends. Mm. You know, and it's a nice feeling. It's a nice feeling having sort of even if it's the smallest part, I really enjoy that sort of stuff.
Well, it's the ripples, isn't it? You know, you're making these connections and having this influence. And, you know, like you say, you just like to see people do well who have got talent and making good stuff.
Still now, I have to say. Yeah. I mean, anything, you know, just as much as, you know, when they first started. So mm-hmm. It's a nice, nice feeling.
I bet it is. So you've lived in America for like, how long have you lived there? Over 10 years, it must be.
11 years now, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, what kind of prompted that move, and how have you seen the scene change during your time living over there?
Yeah, so I moved out here, I guess, probably like the sort of around like that EDM kind of era. Mm-hmm. I felt like the scene was dying on its ass. I got caught up in the EDM thing right at the beginning. I started listening to people and like getting influenced on what I should be doing with my music, and quite a miserable, dark period, to be honest with you. But I was getting a lot of work out in America. There was traction happening with my records, and I really enjoyed the attitude out here. Of just felt like you could do whatever you wanted, and it was kind of accepted. I enjoyed that. Mm. I just followed the opportunity. I felt like I'd done some really fun things in Europe, but I felt like this calling here. My wife, she lived in America most of her life. She felt comfortable out here, you know.
Yeah.
Happy wife, happy life. So, we came out here and made a go of it. And it's been really fun watching the progression of a scene that, even though it's essentially it completely started here, it didn't continue here in the way that the scene was adopted in Europe, in the UK, in core of like youth culture. So it was nice to be involved in it and now seeing it in comparison to what it was like, 11 years ago. It's grown up so much. It's so deep. It's so like, it's just really popular. It's nice to be involved in it I'm honestly doing shows right now I never ever thought I'd be doing. And having influence in a way even that I never thought I'd ever have. It's unbelievable. It's mind-boggling. It's great fun.
Yeah. You know, I think looking at it from like a cultural perspective as well, like you say, it started in the States, like house music, dance music, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, then Europe kind of adopted it, morphed it into its own thing. And then, you know, obviously the EDM explosion, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it's kind of much maligned at the moment with like hindsight. However, you know, that for me, looking at it now, is kind of like that was like the gateway drug for a whole new scene of people, like you say, who have grown up and they are into dance culture. And that's something that they never had before, really.
Yeah, it's great. And it's just the way it works. It's like, I always believed in it. I always believed that would happen. People's tastes change all the time. It's I always had faith that it would grow like this. And it's just great to be involved in it.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, you've kind of alluded to it as well, in like that, you know, there was a dark period, or you know, you were doing things that you weren't necessarily completely invested in yourself. And you've been quite open in like other interviews and things that I've read about, you know, taking stock of your own sound and, you know, course correcting yourself back to a place where you felt more connected to the music. I mean, can you mm-hmm. tell us, kind of just elaborate on that a little bit, and why you did it and why it's so important?
It's if you were to ask me, like, what I'm most proud of in my career, the thing that I'm most proud of in my career is that I had, essentially for me, I'd completely gone off track and departed from my core values and allowed external influence and had stopped using my intrinsic like judgment at the core of my career. And the thing that I'm the most proud of is that I recognized it, adjusted it. And I didn't have confidence in my own music as well. I'd started exploring working with other engineers to try and get a sound. It wasn't really ending up feeling like my own. Anyway, I course corrected. Mm. I recognized. I knew I was doing things that I just wasn't enjoying. I was taking shows I wasn't enjoying. I was playing some music I wasn't fully loving. I was playing music for reactions rather than. I was playing a game, which is not what I ever wanted to do. I'd never wanted to play a game. And anyway, I course corrected. I remember having this moment in, I think I was in Korea, and I was playing a show, and I was just like, what the fuck am I doing? And I did. I just had this moment. I was like, what the fuck am I doing? I went to Scotland shortly after, and I was went to my parents' house and had a few days there, and just mentally took stock, trying to figure out what I was doing, and just started, you know, making music that felt more connected to me again. And that was like the bedrock of, okay, right, I'm gonna course correct. I'm gonna do whatever I can to get my career back on track. And I'd started working with a new manager by this point, my current manager, and we made a long-term plan on what I was going to do and what I wanted to be and where you know, and how I was going to do it. And we enacted it, mm-hmm. and it's all happened.
No way. Tick, tick.
All of it. Bar none, and it's 20 times better than I ever expected.
Well,
I'm really proud of I knew probably what the right decision was to do. And the right decision was to go sack it all off, build a wall around it, start a new project.
Yeah.
That would have been the easiest thing to do. And that's probably what I would have recommended anyone to do. Mm-hmm. But I was like, nah, this is my name. This is my real name. And I feel like this is a reflection on me. And I really wanted to, I wanted to fix it. I wanted to present things the way that I felt comfortable with. So, you know, I did it, and I'm genuinely proud of it. And, you know, I don't give a shit what people think about it, because I'm happy with it. So.
No, I mean, you should be proud, because that's a really brave move to be like, right, because it would just be so easy just to be like, you know, even if you're on stage or at a gig or whatever, like, what the fuck am I doing? I'm playing music I don't really like. But it'd just be so easy just to continue doing that and getting kind of rewarded for it, but not like emotionally.
And this is the thing, you know, I don't like that. That's been, you know, over 10 years now, I don't make decisions for money. Yeah. I don't make decisions for, I don't play like, it, like you're talking about that playing that game. I just don't do it. And I don't do things to fit in either.
Mm-hmm.
I do things that fit for me. That's a big thing. And it makes me happy, and it makes me feel very comfortable with what I do, because it intrinsically is right for me, what I do. So yeah. Anyway, sounds kind of deep, but yeah.
No, it should be. You know, you're looking into yourself and you're recognizing these aspects of your own personality that you want to, you know, you want to hold dear to yourself to move forward. It's what we should all be doing more of, to be honest. Right, I want to talk to you about more kind of modern times. Earlier this year, you dropped the VIP remix of Deceiver. Your collab with Green Velvet, you've already mentioned his name. I mean, this track has been a long time coming. I feel like on your, you know, every time I've seen it posted somewhere on a video or something like that, just the comments of people just begging for this tune. You know, can you tell us about like the gestation of that track, why that version of it took so long to come out, and why now was the right time to kind of release it?
It's pretty simple. I had no intention of releasing it. During COVID, my mate Chris Lorenzo was doing one of those drive-in shows, and he calls me up and he's like, a drive-in show in a couple of days, I want you to make a VIP of one of your songs, make me a special version. I was like, fuck off, mate. Hung up the phone. And I was like, maybe I should give it a try. Maybe I'll try do something. And I was like, do you know what? I'll pull in the stems for Deceiver. I'll give it a go. And I did that in an hour. It took an hour to knock up. And I was like, do you know what? Sweet. I've never touched it since. I never did anything else to it. And I gave it to Chris, and he's like, mate, that version absolutely tore the roof off the place when he played it. And I'm like, okay, sweet, I'm gonna just there's a nice little version that only me and you have. I gave it to Fish as well. Mm-hmm. It was just the three of us that had it. I actually forgot to give it to Curtis, like, for years. I only gave it to him like 6 months ago or something. I realized, like, oh shit, I should have really, like, it's really bad that I never sent it to him, but sorry, Curtis. But anyway, I'd been playing it for years, and I'm like, do you know what? I've got a lot of. I like having versions that I only have to play, because it's sort of. Listen, it's a very difficult scene now. There's so much music out there. It's so easy to get most things that are out there quite quickly. The only way that I can have any separation or give any separation from my live shows is to have things that no one else has, and it's normally involving things that I've made. So I kept that as something to make my sets different and unique for a while. But I was, you know, I just got to that point of, like, I've been working hard lately, and I've got a load of new music that I'm making to, you know, to reinvigorate my sets in regards to the music that I've made for my sets. And I was like, you know what, it's time, I can give this up. So let people have.
For me, it reminded me of that kind of era, like, you know, we've talked about that progressive house era, where there would be DJs that would have tracks, like a few would have like a copy of something, and it would either never be released, or, you know, it'd take years to come out. And if you wanted to hear that, you would have to hope that they played it when you went to watch them live.
That's the unfortunate thing. We all want what we can't have. Well, if I don't give it to anyone, no one can have it. So it's like, it creates some demand. It does work.
All right. So I wanted to talk about Fisher as well. You've already mentioned him. And before we turned on the mics as well, you said that you're going to be flying out and seeing him in Vegas, and you're going to catch up. You haven't seen each other for a while. You know, how did you guys first kind of meet? Because his kind of story and entry to the world of dance music is quite interesting. Obviously, he was a pro surfer. Yeah. You know, what's your relationship?
So, you know, we're nothing alike, but just that's quite a common thing with some of the people that I'm closest with. I'd say some of the closest people in my life would be Chris Lorenzo, Fish, Mickey Slim. They're all fucking nutbags, and I'm not like that. I'm a really chill, and I just really get on well with these crazy people. And I met Fish through my manager, Brett. He was managing him as well. He was managing Cutsnake, and that was his project with Leigh Sedley. Mm-hmm. Leigh Sedley. And, I met him and just got on really well with both of them. I love them. They're like really, truly great guys. Really great guys. And love the music, and the energy is so refreshing. People are seeing that now. Mm-hmm. That his energy is truly infectious, and it's difficult to have a bad night out with Fish. It really is. He is so much fun. Mm-hmm. unless he's a bad, unless he's in a bad mood and he's a fucking miserable, wretched cunt to be with. but just like anyone, but he's brilliant. I love him, and we just have a great relationship. We're just friends, and he's massively helped me with my his opinions on my music and my, you know, what I'm doing. And even though I was explaining to you, I'm quite decisive and I do things for myself, and you know, it doesn't mean that I don't have influence, but I choose who influences me. Yeah. For sure. And he's definitely one of them. He's been fantastic. His energy's phenomenal. Anyway, you know, we all have the same manager and a lot of the same friends and colleagues and everything. And it's just great. It's great. He's a fantastic energy to have. And I'm so happy for how he's how things have progressed for him over the last few years. It's been phenomenal. And the fact that I get to go up on stage with him as well and do these back to backs, that like is one of our it's actually him calling now. is one of our most popular things to do. It's like our most requested booking.
Yeah.
We don't do it very often. I love getting up on stage and just having a laugh with him. It's fantastic.
It's the time of the interview where we do the House Culture Perfect playlist. You've submitted 5 tracks based on our themes. You can find the playlist on Spotify. It's House Culture Perfect playlist. Everyone submitted to this. And we always start, the first theme is a catalyst tune, something that opened your ears to electronic music, got you into dance music. You have chosen Robert Miles's Children. Why did you choose that?
I was in Northern Ireland. I was in school. I don't know what was happening. It was like one of those free periods or whatever. And that song came on the radio and it mesmerized me. I'll never forget that feeling of first hearing that record. That was the first time I was like, it lit something up inside of me. I think that song's magical. I still listen to it regularly. Mm-hmm. I think it's a phenomenal song. The story behind it's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's a truly inspirational piece of music. It deserves all the plaudits it gets. Yeah, but it was the gateway song for me to get into dance music. I love it.
Perfect. And so I've asked you for a floor filler. You've chosen your own edit.
I said my one, didn't I? I said Prince Funk and Roll.
That's right, yeah.
This thing's a beast. But I can't release the bloody thing because of Prince. And yeah, I tried so hard to get this thing released before he passed. But everyone loved it, but couldn't get it past Prince. All the producers involved in the song, the label, they all wanted to do it. It's probably one of my favorite things I ever did. But anyway, yeah.
High praise.
Just absolutely goes off.
Yeah.
Every time I can play it anywhere and it works a treat. So anyway.
Great choice. Okay, a sunsetter. You've chosen Joris Vaughan's Ringo. Oh,
yeah, I don't know. I love Joris. I love his production. I think touches into that old prog kind of prog vibe. But I just think he just tapped into a truly unique emotion on that song. And I've played it a few times in settings like that. I just think it's a stunning record. Ironically, I could have chosen that record for the next one.
Indeed.
For your next question.
Yeah.
I could have chosen that one.
Yeah. It's highly emotional. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So a tearjerker is the next one, which, and you've chosen, do you want to say what you've chosen?
Yeah. Yeah. I've chosen Massive Attack Teardrop. I'm quite determined for that song to be played at my funeral so that everyone sobs at my passing. I just think the song is absolutely fantastic. If there was any song that I could wish that I had made, it's that one. I think it's phenomenal. The way that it crescendos up and I can't remember the bit, like towards the end of the song. With the big strings, yeah. Then it like drops and... I love trip hop. It's fantastic.
Yeah, so do I. It's got that iconic video as well with the baby. Yeah, it's just, yeah, it's mesmerizing, that tune. Okay, a last tune. Crowd are asking for one more. You've sent me the link to this on SoundCloud, which is, I just saw the title of it and was like, oh, it can't be like a sample from Cypress Hill. And it's, yeah, it's, go on, say what it is.
It's the Cause and Effect bootleg of Snatch My Crops. I don't even know what the original song is.
Insane in the Brain, yeah.
In the Brain, yeah.
And it's, yeah, and then yeah, the sample is cops come and try and snatch my crops.
You play it. You put it on, and it starts with the Cypress Hill song, and I'm sure everyone's thinking, oh my god, here we go. It's a fucking house DJ being ironic, playing a kind of hip hop record or whatever, and then it switches up and goes into the house tempo, and it's so much fun. It just, like, the way that it drops, the way that it switches up, and it just lights everyone up. It's a great way to send everyone off on their send everyone off on a night out, at least for my sets anyway. I love it. It's brilliant.
As it should be. Yeah.
And it's also Cause and Effect is, one half of that is Chris Lorenzo, who's one of my best mates. So.
It's time for the final question. We always ask our guests, this is the final question. We are House Culture. You are part of the House Culture podcast now. The term House Culture, in terms of a scene, what's your view on it? And what do you think it's brought you in your life?
I've always felt that, like, House Culture is kind of openness. I think of it as like a kind of like a community kind of thing. It's like a, I've always felt that it's a quite an open culture. It's like and quite inclusive as well. I always enjoy the fact that I felt like on the event side, it was like this sort of like a place and a scene and a license to kind of like be who you are and be who you want to be kind of thing. And it was the, you know, that was the place where, you know, I got to experience all different cultures and different sexualities and all things like that. And I value the fact that the scene is kind of like giving me exposure and understanding to all of these side of things. So that's what I think about when I think about house culture, and I just think about. That's the main thing that I think about. I just like this sort of just bringing this culture of bringing people together. I love it. It's the vibes are fantastic at house events. I don't have much else to offer them.
No,
that's where my head goes.
Yeah, that's a perfect place to finish on. That's a great final thought. So thank you for taking part.
Thank you very much. It was great fun. Great talking. Take care.
House Culture.
That was great fun, wasn't it? Thanks to Chris for finding the time to chat to us ahead of him jetting over to Vegas to party with his good friend Fisher. I can only imagine what you guys got up to. It was also so interesting to hear about Chris's journey in discovering dance music from afar, especially by frequenting things like the Global Underground message board. I'm sure there are a few people listening right now who can remember that one, myself included. Chris's latest release, Beggin', is out now and is an infectious affair featuring the sultry pipes of singer-songwriter Aluna. Make sure you check it out in all the usual places. And if you can't get enough of sick beats like that, make sure you hit up the House Culture Perfect playlist on Spotify, which features not only Chris's stellar submissions, but also those of every other guest that has graced this show. Stick it on shuffle, turn the volume to maximum. Whilst you're there, please drop us a comment about this episode in the Q&A section under the episode description. Or if you're not on Spotify, leave us a review on Apple, some feedback on YouTube, or your thoughts on Instagram. If you have enjoyed this episode, there really is no excuse. We love to hear from you, and anyone who says something nice will get a shout out on a future episode. Which is why I'm saying a huge hi to the Instagrammer Real Rich Neeks, who got in touch to tell us that he thinks our podcast is excellent and how we should keep pushing because it is important to the culture. You said it, man. It's exactly what drives us on. Thanks for that wonderful message. Don't forget that you can get in touch with us the same way on Instagram by following us at HouseCultureNet or by following the hashtag TrueHouseCulture. And if you haven't already, you can follow me directly on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening. Rave safe and see you next time.
House Culture.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.